You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 140 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcino, the Sean Kemp edition of the Peltoncast. We have to start taking away the ones because nobody wears numbers in the hundreds.
It's true. Maybe in Japanese baseball, but sadly, I don't know.
Until the Mariners are part of the Japanese league.
Yeah. Then we'll be able to do it.
Kyle Seager will be number 140 next year.
With the Seahawks playoff loss on Saturday night, first off, hopefully you already listened to our emergency podcast recapping the game. Tristan threw both his shoes.
Uh-huh. I also pushed over a toy Thomas the Train. I don't know if we talked about that as much, but it did happen.
I didn't even realize that happened because I was in the zone.
You were in the zone.
Given the timing of that and then also our trips to LA later this week, we're not going to have a regularly weekly Pelton cast for you. But instead, a special treat is we're going to look back on the 2018 Seahawks season and look ahead with the help of one of our favorite third Pelton brothers.
Well, and before we get to him, you mentioned that we're going to LA. We're going to have a full LA food recap pod next week because we are going to, and have done when you were there for the Rose Bowl, some eating in LA. I'm fired up about it.
I'm very excited to talk about the places that I went previously. We saved it from last week's pod because we had too much to get to.
The real reason that the Seahawks lost that game on Saturday was because they knew it would have been incredibly complicated for both of us had they won and the Eagles won and were playing in LA on Saturday night opposite back-to-back live at the bootleg. That would have complicated our lives way too much, so the Seahawks had to lose.
Yeah, I would have handled that. That would not have been a concern for me.
I don't know what I would have done. So the good news is the Seahawks lost for that. But if you're going to be in LA for that podcast, definitely come and say hi. We'll be there early and hanging out. We'll be around at the VIP meet and greet. We'll be at the show. We'll be happy to... We'll be at karaoke beforehand. We're doing all the things. So if you're going to be at back-to-back, come and say hi. It should be a fun weekend in LA not watching the Seahawks. However, there are going to be a lot of Cowboys fans.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, it's going to be a weird weekend in LA.
Oh, that's not fun. Well, I already had to deal with a bunch of Ohio State fans last week after they won the Rose Bowl, so I guess I have experience with it at this point.
We're lucky that we didn't book a hotel or flights late.
Yes. Yes. That was good thinking. To help us look back on the Seahawks season, that concluded on Sunday night with their loss to the Dallas Cowboys in the wild card round, I should say. There was only one person that we could bring in. That's right, it's Danny O'Neill's economist friend, staying up way past his bedtime to join us from The Athletic Seattle. Please welcome back to the podcast, longtime third Pelton brother, Ben Baldwin.
Thanks for having me. It is 8:55 Eastern time, PM, and I am the only person who is awake in this house already.
Wow, that is so different from Tristan's household.
It's insane. There were children up till about midnight yesterday.
Oh my gosh. I haven't been up till midnight in many years, and I'm not even a child.
Like people who go to bed early on the West Coast, they celebrate the East Coast New Year's. Did you celebrate like London New Year's?
I think we went to bed even earlier than usual that night. So, we just went to bed and then got up and it was the next year already.
Oh my God. Wow.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
We are not here to discuss time zones or any Pelton cast geography, alas, although that would be a good entry into the bingo cards that Ben does after each Pelton cast. Let's start with, we obviously talked through our thoughts about the Seahawks loss and their game plan and the problems therein and their inability to recognize the problems therein in our emergency pod after Saturday night's game. Ben, anything you want to kind of add to that perspective?
So I obviously co-signed everything that you guys felt on the pod. The one thing I did want to add was that it's not just the run versus pass balance was out of whack for a team that has Russell Wilson against a good run defense. It's also the Seahawks are really good at play action passing, and first down is the most effective down to play action pass. So it's not just that rush attempts are generally going to be putting you in a second and long, being negative EPA, all that. they're foregoing these chances to have huge chunk plays. And when they did try them, they connected on them. That I think all of their points were on drives where they hit a long passing play. So it's really frustrating to follow a team that has a very well-defined strength, but just does not want to lean on that strength, even in a win or go home situation like the playoffs were. So that's my thoughts on Seahawks Cowboys.
The Mother Nature also had a review of the Seahawks game plan last night when the skies opened up late after the Seahawks game for one of the biggest windstorms, easily the biggest windstorm of this winter. One of the biggest windstorms I remember for a long time. Like at 1:30, I was awoken by a loud boom of wind and then trees falling everywhere, transistors blowing in the distance. That to me felt like the perfect review of the Seahawks offensive game plan on Saturday night.
And also the pending offseason, perhaps. We'll get to that.
Oh, Lord. It also was just a little bit frustrating seeing the outcomes of all the other games when there was a stat that I'd seen earlier in the morning yesterday where there was one previous time when all four of the road quarterbacks in the wild card round had won a playoff game before and all four of the home quarterbacks hadn't. And I think that was 2012, maybe I don't remember which year it was. One year that Russ was going on the road. And the first time that it happened...
Well, it couldn't have been 2012 because Russ hadn't won.
Well, okay, maybe it was 2014. I don't remember which one it was. But all four of the road quarterbacks won that previous time. And this year it could have happened again, except for the fact that the Seahawks couldn't pull it off in Dallas.
And they really should have. The people who picked the Seahawks to win because Seattle had the quarterback advantage, it's not like anything happened in that game that would lead you to reconsider the whole quarterback thing. The Seahawks just didn't actually let Russell go win the game for them.
Yeah, the other frustrating thing that happened is Philadelphia, with their win in Chicago, kept alive what would have been the slim hope of a 5-6 NFC championship game, and the Seahawks actually getting to host that game.
And also, if the Seahawks had won, they'd be playing the Rams next weekend. And the Seahawks, like, I think they could beat the Rams. The Seahawks would definitely believe they could. And if the Seahawks made the Rams go one and done, it would just be an incredible scene on the internet. So it's really a shame we didn't get to witness that.
If there were a Rams Twitter, it would totally melt down.
That's true. There is a Todd Gurley Twitter. I don't know if there's a Rams Twitter.
That's true. You're well acquainted with Todd Gurley Twitter. We're CJ Anderson Twitter, this trio right here. I did want to get into you, I thought, made an interesting point about how it wasn't just Seahawks Twitter that was melting down over the play calling last night. It was also NFL analytics Twitter, which just could not believe what they were seeing.
Yeah, and not even analytics Twitter. It's like every fantasy football account I follow, every like all these people who work for NFL or ESPN, national media, ESPN, everyone is just like, you guys have Russell Wilson, what are you doing? And then there's the circling the wagons from the local Seattle media that got all indignant that people were criticizing Brian Schottenheimer. So it's been a very interesting 24 hours on the internet.
I will say, as usual, I mean, I don't know how much Brian Schottenheimer is to blame here as opposed to Pete Carroll. Like, he's just such an extension of Pete Carroll philosophically that it's tough to know where one begins and the other ends.
Yeah, I would call, this is going to sound harsh, but I would call Schottenheimer a symptom and not the actual disease. Maybe disease is the wrong word, but yeah.
The idea that was floated on the internet today, you mentioned all the national people talking about, and I feel like we're even going too long on this game because we really should be looking forward on this podcast, but or at least looking back at the entire season.
Let's give some context for when we talk good about Shoddy in a second here.
That's going to happen?
I mean, I think it's inevitably going to happen.
Wow. We have a very different perspective on the season then.
I've looked up what our preseason expectations were.
But the idea that the local media who's out there, not to name names, saying that the national media who was criticizing this game plan just didn't see the Seahawks all year, and you have to go with what got you there or whatever. The idea that you have to run a game plan even if it's not working because it got you to the situation that you're in is just the most ridiculous argument.
And I'm also kind of skeptical about the idea that Seattle running the ball at a high rate is what got them there in the first place, but I'm guessing we'll get to that as we look back over the season.
I mean, it is interesting. So let's. So when we podcasted leading up to week one, back when Ben was constantly associated with the effects of altitude on playing on the road and travel. That seems like so long ago. We decided one thing we wanted to do was set kind of a baseline expectations for all three phases of the game, to in part to help evaluate the new coordinators on both offense and defense, and then just also as a framework to think about the season. So I went back this afternoon and re-listened to that podcast, and here's what everybody had to say. Offense, Ben, I think 14th probably has to be the baseline, which is where they finished last year in DVOA. Which is what we were kind of using to denominate this. The one place for optimism is that the offensive line did look better in the preseason. I wouldn't be surprised if they finished in the 10 to 12 range. If they finish any better than that, it's because Russell Wilson got pass protection and went nuts. So I think we were kind of somewhere in between maybe the, you know, your base case scenario and your optimistic scenario.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Finished 9th in offensive DVOA, so a little bit higher than that 10th to 12th place. Tristan, you said, I think that they should be a top 10 offense. And then I really actually didn't give an answer on this one. I just kind of agreed with everyone.
Wow, skirted the question.
No, well, that's why I need Shoddy.
You're a true professional journalist.
I need Shoddy to come in and supply me some accountability here.
should be a top 10 offense. We're a top 10 offense. Mission accomplished.
I mean, I think the one thing you have to say is, like, as frustrated as the offense was, it did probably slightly exceed our expectations. The other question here, we talked about where does Pete Carroll end and Ryan Schottenheimer begin. How do you split that credit between Shoddy and then Mike Solari, who I think probably deserves the lion's share of the credit for this team overperforming expectations on offense?
Yeah, I think the pass protection was definitely a huge part of the story. And even on that, it's hard to know, like, how much Solari shouldn't get any credit for Dwayne Brown being there for a full season rather than half a season, right? He probably shouldn't get credit for swapping out two of the worst offensive guards in the league for DJ Fluker and J.R. Sweezy. And then there's the question of Ifedi. So how much of Ifedi's improvement in year three should be kind of natural improvement versus defensive line coach? I don't know if there's really a way to answer that, but the improved offensive line play definitely did help the Seahawks a lot, and passing efficiently is what primarily, I think, led them to be a top 10 offense.
I mean, they did also improve dramatically in terms of, you know, their rushing DVOA. I mean, that was maybe in some ways the bigger difference from, you know, 2017 when they still tried to run the ball a fair amount, but were dreadful at it. They, you know, were 23rd in rushing DVOA in 2017, improved into the top 10 in that category this year. And again, I think, you know, we're in the category of people who place the credit for that much more on the offensive line than on the running backs.
Yeah, I would not say that spending a first round pick on a running back is what caused that improvement.
It's really tough to make. Well,
yeah, definitely not that running back. There's no real way that you could argue that the Rashad Penny pick improved the Seahawks running game.
Well, that's why they used it on generational talent, Mike Davis.
Yeah.
All right. Defensively, we were all pretty much in agreement. Ben, maybe like an average defense, and if they're better than that, Pete Carroll is an actual defensive magician. Tristan, average defense feels about right to me. I'm going to say 16th. Kevin, yeah, that feels right to me. Lo and behold, the Seahawks finished in DVOA. I'm pretty sure they finished 16th, right? 14th. No, I guess they were.
Might have been 14th, yeah.
But they were
pretty close.
And they were almost exactly average, minus 0.2% if you look at that in terms of the rankings. So, yeah, the team was what we thought they were. Although, of course, that was most of the season without Earl Thomas, who we assumed would make a major difference in terms of their success defensively.
Yeah, and the caveat on offense, too, is that if you had told us before we made our predictions that Doug Baldwin would miss most of the season, I think we probably would have been a lot lower on them, too.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely knew his injuries were going to be a factor, but not necessarily how much.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a case where it, also DVOA tells a different story than the per play expected points added that you, Ben, and other people have been tracking all season, where they point out that particularly on first and second down, the Seahawks were one of the worst defenses in the league.
Yeah, they were in the top two or three worst defenses on base down, so basically first and second down outside of the red zone. And they were spectacular on third downs and in the red zone. Unfortunately, that didn't quite carry over to last night, at least in the red zone. And there's a question of how sustainable that is. If the NFL season were 32 games or something, would regression hit them there too? And maybe we find out that they're actually not an average defense, but a well below average defense. But at least during the course of this regular season, I think average defense is probably fair. And over the offseason, they're going to hopefully need to add a lot of talent there.
I'm really surprised that DVOA has them at 14th. I thought they were going to be like 18th there. So being an above average defense, honestly, is a little surprising to me. Also, I'm going to throw a shoe about the red zone and third downs not carrying over again. But I think there has to be some credit for Ken Norton, Pete Carroll, and the defensive staff for the season. You know, offensively, I'm a little bit more skeptical about it, partially just because Russell Wilson had such an excellent season, the offensive line being improved a little bit. That almost felt like addition because of subtraction, and then stabilizing the line a little bit. They did minor things that made the offense that much better. But I think this offense has the potential to, maybe with a couple of tweaks, be a top five offense. You know, I think being a top 10 offense was underachieving for this offense this year. However, the defense, with the talent that they had and the talent that they lost, finishing at 14th was still pretty impressive. I mean, if we would have gone in the season knowing that Trey Flowers was going to be starting at one of the cornerback positions, that they'd be without KJ Wright for a huge chunk of time, that Earl Thomas was going to report to camp and then only play in four games, the way that we would have viewed this defense probably would have been a bottom 10 defense.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, and obviously the Thomas situation was a big point of discussion, and, you know, we had different perspectives on how much of the season he might actually play. I don't think we were factoring in 16 games of Earl Thomas, but we also were probably factoring in more than four games of Earl Thomas into those projections.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the talent is there that on offense they could be better, and just because of philosophical reasons, they weren't. But on defense, it's hard to be super disappointed with their performance, even in the playoff game.
I guess to go back to what you said at the end of when we were just talking about the Dallas game, I mean, I think that the viewpoint of people who believe in the Seahawks offensive philosophy is that they achieved a top 10 offense because of it. I think we probably look at it as more as they managed to somehow be a top 10 offense despite the offensive philosophy, because Russell Wilson was just that good, and Tyler Lockett.
And Tyler Lockett,
yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of it just goes to how you view Russell Wilson. If you think he's one of the best quarterbacks in the league, like Kevin and I do, then you would expect Seattle to have a really good offense. But if you think he's in the number 14 range, like Tristan does, then...
all credit to Shoddy over here.
Yeah. Then you might think that Seattle's offense is only good because of the commitment to their run game.
Well, I think a huge amount of credit for the defense, too, I mean, beyond Ken Norton, Pete Carroll, has to go to the defensive line and how much they stepped up this season, the pressure that Frank Clark and Jaron Reed got. I mean, even in that game last night, they were flying around. Like, those look like two superstar young defensive players on the D-line. And we knew that they were good going into the season, but really made a leap this year.
Reed in particular. But also one thing I said in that preview podcast was, you know, Clark has produced opposite Michael Bennett, but this is the first time that we're going to be seeing him as the premier pass rusher for the Seahawks. And he 100% responded. Also, there was a lot of talk about Rasheem Green is a factor in the pass rush in that.
And free Rasheem Green.
He ends up a healthy scratch for the last two games of the season, including the playoff game. But that's, I think, as much a testament to the fact that Jacob Martin came in and gave the Seahawks really effective pass rush as a late round pick. That was exciting.
Yeah, they got almost nothing from any of their first four round picks, I think, but then at least Jacob Martin and Trey Flowers kind of salvaged, as well as Michael Dixon, obviously the back end of the draft.
I was gonna say, how dare you not mention?
They got a lot from Thrill in his time.
Yeah,
in his short-lived time.
A big what if for the season too is if he had stayed healthy.
Well, then we wouldn't have gotten a George Fant catch, and we wouldn't have our national anthem. So that would be a real disappointment. As far as the special teams phase of the game, Ben, if they're not top three in punting, I'm going to be disappointed. Janikowski, hopefully an average kicker, and Tyler Lockett, hopefully up to full speed. Tristan, if they're not in the top 10 in special teams, I'll be disappointed and probably surprised. Kevin, if there's one place you can feel good about their chances for improvement, I think special teams, they should be dramatically improved. And for 14 weeks, that was the case. And then everything came apart at the end as the Seahawks ended up finishing 24th in special teams DVOA because of the series of returns against them and the pair of blocked punts in week 17. And lo and behold, that kind of mirrored what we saw in the playoff game with another long punt return from Tavon Austin.
And the missed field goal.
Yeah, although that was such a long one.
A missed field goal.
But the Seahawks ended up finishing four spots worse. The Seahawks ended up finishing four spots worse than 2017 when they ranked 20th in the league in DVOA.
I'm pretty sure the last game caused them to fall. The last regular season game against the Cardinals caused them to fall from number 5 to number 20 in Football Outsiders punting efficiency thing.
Wow. I mean, you think about some of those games. The Cardinals game was close because of special teams. The 49ers game, you could probably look at them losing because of special teams. The Cowboys game last night, seeing so many, the one touchdown that got overturned, but then the long kick return from Austin plus the missed field goal. It was pretty brutal the last few weeks. And, special teams, the margins are so small between teams that having a few awful games can kind of drop you really far.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is even though the Seahawks were better most of the season on special teams, it wasn't a dramatic difference. But I would say that, clearly they're not going to rethink anything offensively based on the quotes we've seen after the game and Pete Carroll saying that the problem was they didn't convert enough third downs, which matched up Ben's run, blame Russ if you don't convert on third down tweet. During the game, very, very apropos. If there is a place where I think that they are going to maybe look at what happened last night and make changes because of it, I think it could be in terms of their special teams coaching.
That would be a welcome change. It's been, or a head coach who at least states that he cares a lot about special teams and emphasizes special teams. They have not been a great special teams team for a while. It'll be interesting to see what they do about Dixon. It seemed like he might have outkicked the coverage last night, although there were still players in place to make the tackle. So are they going to think about the hang time versus getting the ball down the field trade-off? And then, of course, there's the question of place kicker as well. And hopefully they'll sign somebody who's not Sebastian Janikowski.
And when you say sign, you mean draft.
In the first round, yes.
You're very committed to them drafting a kicker. You're going to be disappointed if they don't.
Speaking this. I mentioned someone on the
Bold Predictions podcast.
if they had drafted Michael Dixon in the first round and then kept Michael Bennett instead of getting that fifth for him, would they have been a better team in 2018?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. Right? I mean, they got so much more value from Michael Dixon than they did from Rashad Penny.
So, yeah. So, therefore, a special teams first-round draft pick is defensible. if the alternative is a running back.
It's like the Marquette King had more EPA than Derek Carr argument. I think it's very similar to that one. But yeah, Brian Schneider has been the special teams coordinator for the Seahawks throughout Pete Carroll's tenure. There was a period of time where the Seahawks were very effective on special teams, but you know, despite making pretty massive investments, you know, 2 years ago it was free agency and then the trade for TJ Alexander, and then this year, of course, drafting Michael Dixon. Despite making these investments there, they haven't gotten kind of the returns you would expect, and that's where someone starts to become vulnerable.
Yeah, there's also the question of how much, due to the small sample sizes and special teams, how much of it is just pure randomness. So, right. I'm not exactly defending their special teams coach, and I'd be totally fine with the change, but I just wonder how many games or even years you would need to find out if somebody's actually a good special teams coach.
The answer is Dave Tobe number of years. So in terms of the overall record, I think we all generally agreed that we thought about 8-8 was the most likely outcome for the Seahawks. 10-6 is within that distribution, but they definitely outperformed that. And Ben, that's used to something you wrote about recently on The Athletic. You want to kind of summarize what you found looking back at the analytical projections you reviewed before the season?
Yeah, so a lot of them were based on the premise that Seattle would face a really difficult schedule. The NFC was dominant against the AFC last year. I think it was 41-23. So with that many good teams in the conference, there just aren't as many wins to go around within the conference. So with the Seahawks having to play teams like the Packers and the Panthers that other people thought would be good, people thought the 49ers would be good and the Cardinals wouldn't be a joke. So that was part of what the low win projection for the Seahawks was. And a lot of those things didn't turn out to be true. Another basis for picking the Seahawks to miss the playoffs was, again, that there were just so many other good teams in the NFC. The Seahawks could have finished 10-6 last year and missed the playoffs. So if you thought that the Seahawks would need 11 wins to get into the playoffs this year, then picking them to miss the playoffs was pretty reasonable. But the NFC collapsed, and the Seahawks got the fifth seed, and they got 10 wins by improving, as we talked about before, both their passing efficiency and rushing efficiency.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that you're saying about the NFC is kind of true. It just happened to other teams and not the Seahawks. I mean, it did happen to the Packers, to the Panthers, to the Falcons, teams that had fairly high percentage chances of making the playoffs. They all ended up having kind of brutal seasons for one reason or another. And the Seahawks ended up being fairly steady from what we've seen from them the last few years.
There was a lot of talk. I mean, also, we're going to get to reviewing the over-unders we did before the season, but the combination of those two podcasts, a lot of talk about how great the NFC was relative to the AFC. And
is that not still true, though?
Was it?
I think the NFC had a losing record against the AFC this year.
Wow, that is shocking.
Yeah, which shows how unpredictable that stat is from year to year. I mean, we did mention, I think, when we were talking about the schedule strength, like, look, it's tough to predict because you just don't know how good teams are going to be.
And they're only seeming like there are four good AFC teams. Like, if you ask me, I feel like there are 8 good NFC teams and like 3 good AFC teams.
I don't think that the results bear that out.
Maybe 4. I'm surprised to hear that, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad NFC teams this year, too, which is driving part of it. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. No, for sure. Anything else we want to say about the 2018 season as a whole as we look back?
One mini rant is there's so much commentary that says the Seahawks turned their season around after the first 2 games where they learned that they passed the ball a lot in the first 2 games and the offense didn't work, and then the offense was better afterwards because they started running more. But the first 2 games were against 2 really good defenses on the road. So if you look at the season while excluding 2 of the hardest matchups for the offense, then yeah, the offense is going to look better. And then last night they play against another good defense on the road, and look what happens, they struggle again. So that commentary of the season is, I'm sure that will be discussed over the offseason, and I'm not looking forward to it, but it's probably going to happen.
And very specifically, Chicago was the only top 10 run defense they had faced before Dallas.
Did they play a top 10 defense in weeks 3-17?
Overall defense?
The San Diego Chargers.
Oh, yeah, those great San Diego Chargers. Actually, I guess the Chargers were 10th in run defense. I was missing them. So they did miss play a top 10 team, but of course they lost.
Where were they overall, though? Were there any teams who were in the top 10 overall that the Seahawks played in between there? Oh, Minnesota was a good defense.
Yes, Minnesota was 4th overall, but but not as good at run defense.
But they basically played two of the hardest defenses that they would play. They did play two of the hardest defenses they would play all year in weeks 1 and 2. Ended up probably scapegoating Russ for those games, those losses. Didn't prepare the way that they should have for the Broncos. People probably still don't realize how good that Broncos team actually was and that Vance Joseph should not have been fired. The Bears were a little bit underrated when we played them. What does that look? He should not have been fired. Oh,
I know some people who underrated the Bears, but we're going to get to that.
Oh, God. The Bears were probably underrated in that moment because it was only week 2. We didn't really know what the Bears were at that time. You know, we thought they were still an extension of what they were last year, where they were a bad team.
I think we knew they were going to be better than last year because they had just traded for Khalil Mack.
But we know that they would be that they were going to win the NFC North and win 12 games or whatever. So I think that people definitely overreacted those games, played a series of relatively easy defenses for the rest of the year, and then put up the mission accomplished sign, right?
Like the mission accomplished sign is supposed to be my thing. I don't like you stealing it.
But it's just the problem. We talked about this yesterday. Pete Carroll and the Seahawks front office and regime and coaching don't realize what happened this season. And the quotes after the game say that they didn't realize what happened this season. They looked at a season and they saw the record and the amount of times that they ran the ball, and that's it.
Well, they also saw the number of times they got to 53 combined runs plus completed pass.
Fucking number. Does that seem right, though, Ben?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's also the... Because the Seahawks made the playoffs while most people picked them to miss the playoffs, that means that the Seahawks are above criticism, which is also just a crazy argument to me.
Yes.
It is. There's a fun world to imagine where this exact season happened and you add in Michael Bennett and Sheldon Richardson or some sort a real first round pick and really wonder what this team could have looked like. Even with the same sort of offensive philosophy. Like, I mean, we might have been looking at a team that was really pushing the Rams for the NFC West.
Yeah, they were a couple of plays away from beating the Rams in both games. If you could do a hindsight draft and pick that edge rusher that went to Tennessee, Harold Landry, I think. Does he make more of an impact this season than Rashad Penny? Almost certainly yes. So, yeah, there's... In some senses, it was a success. They made the playoffs when people weren't expecting it, but there's also some missed opportunities there.
Or Derwin James, right? Wasn't Derwin James out there when the Seahawks picked?
No, he was the pick right before.
Okay. But Leighton Vander Esch was the pick after the Seahawks' original selection.
That is correct.
Wow, that's amazing. Wait, who got drafted with that pick?
I don't know that off the top of my head. Harold Landry had 4.5 sacks, by the way, for Tennessee this year.
But the other thing about that is that they're not set up in a great position going forward because they don't have a player like that. What they have and the things that we know about running backs is A, their careers are very short. B, you need to get a lot from them right away. And C, they don't matter at all, so you shouldn't be paying them money, right?
Yep, like, that's about right.
Well, you can get a really good one in the 7th round.
Yes, you can get a really good one in the 7th round. You can get a really good one as an undrafted free agent, which we've seen this year. There was another rookie running back who was an undrafted free agent and is now going to be playing in the Pro Bowl. Like, but so now they're not positioned. If they did have somebody like a Harold Landry, like a Leighton Vander Esch, we'd be looking at this defense and saying, whoa, they have another good young star coming.
Jair Alexander, a cornerback out of Louisville to Green Bay, was that pick with the Seahawks selection originally. Having discussed 2018, let's now turn our attention ahead to this upcoming offseason and repeat something we did with Ben this time last year.
I want to talk a little bit more in general first before we do in and out. Is that what you're going to do?
Okay.
So what do you think, Ben, are going to be the primary focuses during this offseason for the Seahawks front office?
I think this is harder than last year because last year we knew that this team wants to run the ball and they're really bad at it. So they're going to be spending the offseason investing in the run game, which is what happened, maybe even to a greater degree than we even thought. This year, I think their weakness is in the pass rush and secondary and perhaps tight ends and wide receivers, which is kind of a lot. But I would prioritize what's happening on the back end. So both in terms of cornerbacks and safeties, but I'm not sure if the team will see it that way.
Yeah, I think they're going to be really confident in their ability to develop
particularly at cornerback. I mean, and Trey Flowers, as Tristan mentioned earlier, way ahead of any realistic expectations for someone converting from safety to cornerback and drafted as late as he was starting throughout his rookie season. Shaquille Griffin, a disappointing second season that, you know, really showed up, I think, on Saturday night against Dallas. And, you know, if he can improve, that I think is one of the biggest potential sources of improvement for the Seahawks.
What about safety?
Tougher to read what they're thinking there. I mean, you know, I don't know how happy they are with the play of Tedrick and Delano.
It's a complicated, I mean, honestly, both positions are complicated because they are probably one of the defense's biggest weakness, but they are also one of the positions where they have the most young talent. And you look at the linebacking core where Shaquem Griffin probably at this point doesn't look like he's going to be a starting caliber NFL linebacker. And then beyond that, as far as younger players go, you know that Bobby Sett, KJ's a free agent, we'll talk about him a little bit, but there's not a lot of depth there. So I think you should always be adding to the D-line every single offseason. You should be trying to get defensive linemen as much as possible. But I think maybe adding a younger linebacker to the mix could be interesting. I still think that they should draft a safety, but I'm a little bit skeptical about whether they will. Receiver.
It also might not be a place to draft if it, like running back, is going to be a place where players are available cheaply in free agency. And
well, how they added Bradley McDougald, who I think we're all pretty happy with.
For sure.
But I think they definitely need to add kind of a third receiver to the Baldwin-Lockett combo. You know, David Moore had some nice moments throughout the season. But in the end, especially with the struggles late, did he even have a reception or...
He barely played against Dallas.
A target yesterday?
No.
They need a third receiver in there.
And they've always wanted that big-bodied receiver. I mean, Brandon Marshall was in an attempt to do that early this season. But that's a player where if you don't want to get them at the back end of their career... after they're already washed up and they only are a part of the team for 6 weeks, you probably need to draft them pretty early. And the other consideration with wide receiver is that Doug Baldwin isn't getting any younger.
Yeah, and he hurt both of his knees throughout the course of the season.
So that'd be a place I'd definitely want to look at early in the draft if I were the Seahawks.
What about offensive line? Are we just saying that the line is set at this point? You know, they have a couple of young players in Britt and Ifedi, but otherwise, you know, the rest of that line, you know, I guess Fluker's not that old, right?
I think he's mid to upper 20s. So yeah, not super old.
But also as a free agent, right?
He is. We'll get to him.
You know, the guards, they don't feel like this is the guards of the future necessarily. Dwayne Brown, it will probably be an effective lineman for quite a while, but they could definitely use some more depth on the offensive line. If their first pick this year was an offensive lineman, I would not be upset about it.
It also depends what you think George Fant's future is. You know, is he going to be a starting left tackle down the road again?
Yeah, and also Simmons, is he the one who filled in for Fluker when he was injured?
Yep.
So what they do with him is... will also be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, so, and there'll be competition there for sure.
Yeah, I mean, really what we're looking at is as far as things that 100% are going to change this offseason, Sebastian Janikowski's gone.
Yes.
David Moore almost certainly will not be the number three receiver at the beginning of next year.
Yeah.
Hopefully. That's the optimistic view of the Seahawks.
They're going to draft a running back in the first round. These are the truths that we know. But otherwise, yeah. It's a lot of just building up competition and depth beyond that, right?
Yeah, I don't expect them to be like real aggressive with the cap space that they have, particularly because they're going to need a lot of it.
When you say that is when they trade for Percy Harvin or Jimmy Graham.
That's true. That happened, I believe I said that almost like 24 hours before the Jimmy Graham trade, if I recall correctly.
I hope you like Antonio Brown because he's coming.
It's going to be great when they throw to him four times again. But you're going to need to earmark a lot of cap space for Frank Clark's new contract and then possible extensions for Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner. And so I think that's the main use of that rather than going out and trying to sign an impact player.
Yeah, I think that's right. They haven't made huge... They have made trades, but huge splashes in free agency haven't really been their thing, which I'm okay with.
Sam, should we do in and out now?
All right.
All right, we start with Frank Clark.
I think he's in.
100% in.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little question that he's in. It's just a matter of how much it's going to cost when they back that Brinks truck up to his house.
Yeah, my take was that I thought he was going to be the highest paid highest paid free agent of this offseason. So not a re-signing. Yes, a re-signing, but not like Russell Wilson.
Not
right?
an extension.
Not an extension, but the highest paid free agent this offseason. I think Clowney's going to get a lot of money also, yeah. But it'll be between one of those two.
Isn't DeMarcus Lawrence a free agent? He is going to get a ton of money, I think.
And it kind of shows sort of, I don't want to call it the new NFL, but like those pass rushers are going to be, it's going to be quarterbacks and then, you know, pass rushing linebackers, pass rushing defensive linemen who are going to be the highest paid players.
Yep.
Which makes sense in a league that is dominated by how well you pass and stop the pass. Yes, Lawrence is also a free agent. Next up, Earl Thomas.
As much as I would like him to stay, I think that bridge has been burned.
I believe that bridge got flipped off. So
the injustice is not forgotten.
I mean, I think one thing that I mentioned this maybe before with Earl Thomas is, like, I think there is a thing where, you know, if you're going to settle for less money than you're expecting, it's easier to do that with another team than it is with the team that you think should value you more because you've been playing for them for years.
Yeah. If you were running the Seahawks, would you re-sign him if he was willing to?
I mean, it depends on the same thing, but I would definitely re-sign him at market value because I think that market value for safeties is generally so low.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to ask that question because there's so much baggage between Earl Thomas and the Seahawks. Like, if we were running the Seahawks tomorrow with none of the Earl Thomas history and baggage, sure.
We also probably would have extended him, so it wouldn't even be a question. Yeah.
Probably would have handled the whole Earl Thomas situation differently. But it's going to be, I'm just really hoping he's in the AFC next year.
Yeah. Chiefs would be a good spot for him. KJ Wright.
This one's hard. The defense definitely looked much different with him on the field. And I don't think he had injury problems like he did this year prior to this season. So I'd be totally comfortable bringing him back. And I really have no feel what the team is going to do, but I guess I'll stay in and not feel great about this prediction.
Yeah, he's in. This is his last contract with the Seahawks.
I agree with what Ben said. I think this is the one that's closest to like a 50-50, and I don't have a good feel for. Michael Kendricks is also a free agent. They liked his play before the injury and I guess before the suspension, but also a little bit after the suspension in the one game he was healthy for in between. I mean, I think maybe I could see a one-year deal for KJ Wright, kind of a prove-it contract along the lines of the ones they've often given to other teams' free agents in the past. DJ Fluker.
I'll say in. I think they like the attitude and everything he brings as a team that wants to be a physical running team, for better or worse.
Going out on DJ Fluker.
Because you think some team's going to come in with a big offer?
I think he's going to get paid too much.
That'd be interesting. I'm going to go in. I just don't think that's going to happen given his past track record. I think the Seahawks will value him more than anyone else. Speaking of the Seahawks valuing him more than anyone else and a guard with initials, J.R. Sweezy.
Yeah, this one's hard too. I'll say in just because it didn't really seem like he had a market, and I'm not sure how much that'll change given his age and injury history.
Yeah, Sweezy's in.
Yeah, I think it comes back at a reasonable number. So I think we're all in there. Lastly, among the free agents, nickel corner Justin Coleman.
This is a long pause. yeah, good thing pauses will get removed. I guess I'll say out for no good reason other than a wild guess.
Let's go in.
I think in. I mean, the Seahawks definitely like his play. They don't have anyone else who really has been. I mean, they've sort of used Akeem King, I guess, in the slot as a sixth corner, but not as, you know, a full-on nickel on the kind of regular basis that. And they also may want Akeem King available to play on the outside, which is a role that he's filled due to injuries at times.
So this offseason looks very different than the previous one.
Yeah, there was a lot of more outs.
There are so many big names then also, where this is like, you know, we're talking about Justin Coleman, J.R. Sweezy. In the past, we were talking about, you know, Seahawk legends.
Yep.
Not to say that J.R. Sweezy isn't a Seahawk legend. But I think the real question for this offseason is going to be more about the extensions than the free agents.
That's where the Seahawks legends come in. So first, we've got, of course, Russell Wilson. And I will reiterate my bold prediction that despite Wilson's comments that he's happy to play out his contract and become a free agent if need be, but still wants to stay in Seattle, I think that there's going to be like 6 months. I guess my math is wrong here. 6.5 months of angst about this. Oh, why hasn't he signed an extension yet? And then he just signs an extension like the day before training camp starts, just like last time.
I could see that.
There's going to be so much debate about this on Seahawks Twitter. Get ready. Get ready for the next 6.5 months.
Can we talk about Ben and hating fries again?
The whole offseason is just going to be how valuable is a quarterback in a run-heavy offense.
Well, I look forward to your mini Athletic Seattle pieces on the subject.
People who have this argument, you know, I think there was a Maze tweet from yesterday where he was like, if the Seahawks are going to run this offense, they should just trade Russell for 3 first-rounders to the Giants or something. Russell Wilson will be coached by another coach aside from Pete Carroll in his career.
Well, then there was the thing that Twitter got into about what if Shoddy is the successor to Russell.
I don't believe that Shoddy is the heir apparent. You know, I think when Pete Carroll is officially done, it is going to be somebody completely outside of the Pete Carroll family.
I don't know if I agree with that, but I also think it's very possible that it could be, you know, well, you'd still maintain continuity. I feel like it could be like Ken Norton could be the next coach of the Seahawks.
It's just when you have a franchise quarterback, you have to think of him as more than just the scheme that they're currently in. They're a franchise quarterback that can function in a number of different schemes, and you have to keep them at all costs.
Yeah. Then, as I also mentioned in our 2019 bold predictions as part of the 2018 Seattle Sports Year Interview, the other extension that no one's talking about is Bobby Wagner heading into the final year of his contract as another future Hall of Famer playing at the top of his game. I said that I boldly predicted that he will become the highest paid middle linebacker in NFL history, surpassing Luke Kuechly. Other thoughts on Bobby Wagner extension?
That wouldn't surprise me. He deserves it.
I think they might let Bobby play it out. Just given the history of what this team has done with defensive players on third contracts, I think there's a chance. I mean, Bobby Wagner, and we talked about this with Mina, I think the team views him as different than everybody else, but I just think that there's a chance that they might wait one more year to make sure that he's not going to get injured.
The other question is, it's probably an easier position at which to franchise someone because of the fact that the franchise tag for middle linebackers is not going to be very expensive. It's not going to be commensurate with what you'd be expecting to pay Wagner on an extension. So maybe that could be a possibility. Anything else on the offseason?
I hesitate to say this. We had a very drama-filled offseason in 2018. It was one of the most drama-filled offseasons that we've ever seen from the Seahawks. We had visits from far-right pundits, or whatever you would call them. We had drafting punters higher than people anticipated that we would. We had drafting.
You're not going to start with firing the coordinators on both sides of the ball.
Just everything all around. Firing Tom Cable, firing the coordinators, kind of the complete overhaul of the team, built in Pete's image. This entire talk about run. This is the team now, though. The team that Pete wanted to build is the team that Pete has on the field. There are going to be a couple of slight tweaks, but I think that, and I really hesitate to predict this, I think we're going to have a mostly fireworks-free offseason for the Seahawks.
I agree with that.
Yeah, in terms of the actual team, the commentary on the team or about the team might get kind of crazy with the Russell Wilson contract, but for the team itself, I think I agree.
So bad news for the Pelton cast.
Duh, that's good news. We got a lot of ramen to talk about.
Oh, we got some great ramen, dude.
So fired up.
And then some sandwiches.
That was the silver lining of that loss, is that we get to eat ramen even sooner.
It's the one thing that's keeping me going. With that in the books, it's time to turn our attention to our over-under picks for the 2018 season, which we did as a special one-off podcast at that same time before the start of the season. Are you ready to review these picks and find out how we did?
I'm ready. I'm pretty sure I remember taking the Dallas Cowboys over, and that's the one thing I feel good about. even though it was completely luck-based because they traded for Amari Cooper. But let's do this.
100% wise. Okay, starting with the Arizona Cardinals, who had a line of 6 wins.
You're just so gleeful when you're starting to read these.
Way back when. Oh, God. I mean, I shouldn't be gleeful on this one because Ben and I both took the over on Arizona based on their strong advanced stats. Tristan went under.
Hello.
And won this one.
There we go.
Atlanta had a line of 9.5 wins. Tristan and Ben both went over that. Oof. I went under based on their 8.1 win projection from Football Outsiders. And lo and behold, due to injuries defensively, despite an amazing season by Matt Ryan in the red zone, free Coach Sark.
I still think that the Falcons are a 10-win team.
Win healthy, yes, but that's why you set it lower than that, because sometimes not win healthy. The Baltimore Ravens had a line of 8.5 wins. Tristan and Ben both went under that. Kevin went over. Got this one as they ended up winning 10 games behind the legs and very rarely the arm of Lamar Jackson, but really behind an amazing defense. The Buffalo Bills, a line of 5.5 wins. Ben and I went under on this one. We were concerned about the fact that Nathan Peterman looked so heavily in the mix. But Tristan went over and got this thanks to Josh Allen.
Did they get to 6 wins? Wow, look at the Bills.
Yeah, good for them. Your logic was mostly that they were like a 9-win season the team the year before, so I don't know how strong that logic was. But, you know.
Isn't that logic strong? They won 6 wins when people didn't expect them to.
Won 6 wins. The Carolina Panthers, a line of 8.5. We all went under here. Tristan made this his first lock, and boy, did we look bad. When they won, they started the season, 8-2, correct?
I think it was 6-2. They didn't even get to 8 wins on the season, right?
They started the season
6-2.
Yeah, okay, 6-2. Then subsequently lost their next 7 games in a row, including the Seahawks 30-27.
And we all went
Carolina.
Under, right?
We all went under, and we all won here.
All right.
So, feeling good about that one. The Chicago Bears, another case where we all went under, disbelieving the Khalil Mack hype, not wanting to put our trust in Mitchell Trubisky, and then the Bears won the NFC North.
What was the line for the Bears?
7.5.
7.5.
We made this prediction after the Mack trade too, right?
Yep. This was spectacularly wrong.
One of the things that surprised me most about this NFL season, and I think this was QBR that I was looking at, but Trubisky being, I think, a top 10 quarterback per QBR, I'm pretty shocked by that still. Because when you watch Trubisky, he never seems like a good quarterback.
Third, actually.
That is just ridiculous.
And it's almost entirely because of his scrambling and running.
Ah, interesting.
But a much better rusher than we were anticipating. I mean, same with Josh Allen. Look, quarterbacks running is very important. It's the one place that quarterbacks get the most undervalued, especially if it's somebody like Josh Allen or like Mitch Trubisky, who are not specifically known as a running quarterback. They get so wildly undervalued there. But then Trubisky can have this type of season and carry the Bears to 13 wins. Is that right? 12 wins?
12 wins.
It would have been 13 if they made a 40-yard field goal tonight, but alas.
Was that how long that field goal was? I thought it was longer than that. I was streaming, so I didn't
think it was just over 40 yards.
Oof. That's a rough one. Another team looking for a new kicker this offseason. Next up, the Cincinnati Bengals with a line of 7 wins. Ben went under, Tristan and I went over, and then with Andy Dalton getting injured late in the season, the Bengals collapsed and finished with 6 wins. The Cleveland Browns had a line of 6 wins coming into this season after their previous winless year. Tristan and I went under, Ben went over, and again, Ben was correct. I liked this comment from Ben on the Browns. Like most people, I like the roster and I'm terrified of the coaching. My comment was, I can't take the over because I saw too many shots of Greg Williams and Todd Haley during Hard Knocks. And I feel like that's at least half right.
Well, they might have been under had they not fired Hugh early in the season.
Right.
Yep.
Dallas Cowboys, a line of 8.5 wins. Ben, as he remembered correctly, did in fact take the over. So did I. Tristan went with the under and said it's, quote, close to a lock.
This is like, man, this is one of my worst seasons at this.
There are many. In fairness, might have been true had they not traded for Amari Cooper midseason. They were headed for an 8-8 worse finish, but then subsequently rebounded to win the NFC East and beat the Seahawks and be one of the final eight teams standing. How about that? Denver Broncos with a line of 7 wins. We all went under here. And this is, I think, a case maybe of bad process, good results, because the Broncos were a really good team by DVOA much of the year, but underperformed that substantially and then collapsed due to injuries at the end and finished with 6 wins. So we all hit this one. Detroit Lions, a line of 7.5. Tristan and I both went over. Ben went under. And that was a great call, as the Lions won 6 games as well.
Wow, Ben, you killed us on this.
The first, like, 5 Kevin read, I got wrong. So we'll see at the end.
especially the ones where people went different ways. I feel like you've done very good in those.
The Green Bay Packers, Ben and I went under here because of the fact that we knew that they had a line of 10 wins, because of the fact that we knew that they had a mediocre quarterback. Tristan somehow defied that, went over, and of course Green Bay, far outside the playoff mix, finished with 6 wins and a tie.
Oh, God.
Houston Texans, a line of 8.5 wins. Tristan and I went under. Ben went over. And Houston was one of the hottest teams in the NFL late in the season, finishing with 11 wins before losing at home in the playoffs. Indianapolis Colts, a line of 7.5 wins. Tristan and Ben went over. I went under here, fearing Andrew Luck's arm strength after he didn't throw a pass longer than 10 yards the entire preseason. And those fears proved unfounded, as Andrew Luck led the Colts to the playoffs and to a victory this weekend. Next up, the Jacksonville Jaguars, a line of 9 wins coming off their appearance in the NFC Championship game in 2017. We were all under here. I made this my first lock, and boy, was it a lock, as Jacksonville won just 5 games this season, fell 4 short of the under, one of the NFL's biggest underachievers.
When one of the conversations that we had during this podcast was about defense being less consistent year to year, which I think was actually not as true this season as it has been in the past.
It was slightly more consistent than usual, but still less consistent than offense.
And I mean, it's something to consider for next season, depending on, you know, how confident you are in Trubisky, that a team like the Bears could end up in this situation again.
Very possible. Kansas City Chiefs, believe it or not, way back in September, had a line of 8.5 wins. You're not going to believe this. They hit the over. We all took the over. We all won on this one. Unfortunately, next up, also in the AFC West, the LA Chargers with a line of 9.5 wins. We all went under on this one. We were skeptical of their ability to win close games and live up to their actual effectiveness as a team. They finally did it, going 12-4 and winning a playoff game.
That's a pretty high over-under, too.
So now the Chargers go at New England next weekend?
Yeah. Wow. They get to play 2 10 a.m. games in a row on the East Coast.
The LA Rams, a line of 10 wins. Ben and I went over this one. Tristan went under. And the Rams cruised to the NFC West Championship with 13 wins. I don't know how good my process was here, because I said that the defense was going to be way better, but the offense was going to regress to the mean, and that didn't happen at all. Not even remotely. We really talked up the Marcus Peters edition. Miami Dolphins, a line of 6.5 wins. Ben and I went over, Tristan went under, and Miami hung around the fringes of the playoff race for a long period of time and ended up with 7 wins. Good hit that God. Over.
It's a bloodbath. My God. I just threw my shoe. Don't worry about it.
Someone's got to defend the shoe's honor. Minnesota Vikings, a line of 10 wins coming off their NFC North championship. We all liked the over here. Kirk Cousins didn't like the over.
He did not like that.
As they finished with 8 wins and a tie to miss the playoffs. New England Patriots, a line of 11 wins. We all went over on this one. It was the first of 2 pushes, as the Patriots went precisely 11-5. New Orleans Saints, a line of 9.5 wins. We all liked the over here, and we were all correct, as the Saints won 13 games to secure the number one seed in the NFC playoffs. Next up, the New York Giants with a line of 7 wins and one of the lines with the most action on the over here of any of them. We all picked the under. Tristan and Ben both made it a best bet.
There we go.
And absolutely, that was correct. Is Saquon Barkley led the Giants to a 5-11 record. That's generational talent, Saquon Barkley, I should say. Unfortunately, the Big Apple's other team, New York Jets.
Oh God, this is my worst bet.
A line of 6 wins. We all went over. Tristan claimed that Todd Bowles was his pick for coach of the year.
There we go.
A pick that looked good for precisely 1 week as they upset Detroit on Monday Night Football in week 1 and ended, of course, with Todd Bowles being fired at season's end after the Jets stumbled their way to a 4-12 finish. I still think Todd Bowles is a good defensive coordinator, for the record.
He's a good coach.
I don't know about a head coach. Oakland Raiders, a line of 7.5 wins. And amazingly, wow, this is after the Khalil Mack trade. They reset it. So there was even odds on both sides at 7.5 wins. We all took the under, of course. Tristan and Ben both made it a best bet for them. And well, they should have, because the Oakland Raiders finished 4-12.
I mean, this is also one. Team's about to move to Vegas. There's so much attention there, where their line is always going to be inflated.
Probably the case. It was a pretty obvious pick. Bill Simmons, in particular, was going all in on Raiders unders before the season, and rightfully so. Philadelphia Eagles, a line of 10.5 wins coming off the Super Bowl championship. Tristan and Ben went over. I went under. I nailed this one as Philadelphia won 7 games, although the magic...
They won more than 7 games.
I'm sorry, won 9 games. Although the magic of Nick Foles has propelled them to the second round of the playoffs. Pittsburgh Steelers, their cross-state rivals, also a line of 10.5 wins. We all liked the over here, and we were all incorrect as Pittsburgh winning 9 games and tying one of them. The San Francisco 49ers, a line of 8.5 wins. Were we ever so young and naive? There was heavy action on the under here. All of us took the under. I made this my second best bet. And, of course, the 49ers, subsequent to Jimmy Garoppolo's injury, 4-12 finish for them, finished 4.5 wins shy of their over. I think that was the largest discrepancy of any team in the negative direction. Seattle Seahawks, 7.5 wins. We all took the over. We were all correct. Should have made that a best bet in hindsight.
By a pretty comfortable margin there for the Seahawks, 7.5. Yeah. So they had a lower over-under than the 49ers.
That is correct.
Wow. Tampa, I guess people were out there boldly predicting that the Niners would be playing in DVOA bowls.
I like that you did that and then also took the under on the Niners.
I made that prediction in January.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of time had passed.
But nothing had really changed. Or I guess you were that concerned about who's the running back from the Vikings who got injured in training camp?
Oh, Jerick McKinnon.
Yeah, who they really seemed to miss with.
He was
Matt
my second. I actually completely forgot about this. He was my second draft pick in the Peltoncast Fantasy League.
Yeah.
I went
Le'Veon Bell.
I went Le'Veon Bell and then Jerick McKinnon. Those are my first. Jesus Christ. Wow, you're bringing back bad memories for me. I vowed next year in the PPR Fantasy League, first 5 rounds, all wide receivers. Because I still had pretty good running backs after that.
It's true.
Whew, my God, man.
Tampa Bay Buccaneers, a line of 6.5 wins. We all went under here, and we were all correct, is Tampa Bay won 5 games, despite one of the league's better passing attacks. The Tennessee Titans, a line of 8 wins. Tristan and Ben went under on this one. I went over strictly on the logic that I had picked so many unders beforehand and therefore got this, as the Titans nearly made the playoffs, missing out on the final day of the season. And then lastly, the Washington professional football team, a line of 7 wins. We all took the over here. After Alex Smith's injury, this ended up the second push of the year.
Oh.
So now we can go through all of these. There were 30 that you had a chance to get because of the 2 pushes. Of those, Tristan got 13.
Oh, God.
I got 18. And Ben, with an excellent performance, 20 out of 30.
That's pretty good. I don't think that's quite Danny Kelly-esque. I can't remember how many he got right, but I'm pretty happy.
Danny got 21, but you'll recall that there were, I guess that was out of 30 because there were two teams at that point that we didn't have lines for because of their injuries at quarterback, Buffalo and Indianapolis. But what's interesting is, I guess I should, I got to make this out of 3,000 then. Danny got 16% return on his investment, which is another thing I track if because of the fact that the lines aren't always at equal odds on these ones. By comparison to that, you got this year, you returned nearly 30% on your investment.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe next year, you know, forget about the whole economist thing, just professional professional NFL gambler.
I wish we had just like opened up some account just to bet the unders on the Raiders and Jaguars. And the Giants, like, too. Those are the three.
It seems to me like of the ones that we all unanimously agreed on, we were pretty right in general.
Yes.
Maybe that's the important thing to look at in the future.
Groupthink?
Yeah.
The Vikings was the one that we missed on, I think. They had a weird season.
We also missed on Chicago under. We were all united on.
That's right.
Oh, and the Chargers under. So we were perfect.
But when we had locks, we were on top of it.
Every single lock hit. So take that to the bank.
There you go.
We were 10 of 15, not counting the pushes, when we all agreed on a team. Huh. So that's pretty good. The return on investment, I had plus 14% return, and Tristan had minus 14% return. So another reminder for him not to wager too much next time he's in Las Vegas. Well, this is always a fun thing to do. We tremendously look forward to going back and reviewing these predictions and laughing at ourselves, but also sometimes taking credit where we were right.
Well, congrats, Ben. That was very nicely done.
Thank you.
Danny set the bar high, but you just about lived up to it, and that was pretty impressive.
Those are big shoes to fill.
Well, on that note, thanks so much for joining us, Ben. Everyone, be sure to check out your work on The Athletic Seattle and, of course, on Twitter at Ben B. Baldwin. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.